Welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. The views and opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of Strong Tower Radio, West Central Michigan Media Ministries, or its employees.
Hello and welcome to Strong Tower Radio Today. Today is Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilich and your host Tom Majeur and Sue Majeur. Hello, Gary.
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
It's going good. And of course, my sister Sue is in Kalamazoo, Michigan. Hi, Sue.
Hello. I'm here thinking green thoughts.
Green thoughts. Okay. In spite of the drought, right?
Yes, because it is droughty here.
Okay, well, we'll talk more about that and much, much more, but would you lead us in a word of prayer?
I will. Heavenly Father, thank you for this opportunity to be together with other people that you have created and that you have made for us to fellowship with, and for us to be able to learn more about you by learning about the things that you are created and that we can praise you for. We have so many things to be thankful for, but especially the things that you created from the very beginning for our health and enjoyment. So we thank you for those things and for this opportunity to learn more about. In your name, amen.
Amen. Amen. Well, Gary, I kind of alluded to that earlier about a drought. You know, about weather is as soon as we record something about drought, it starts raining.
Yeah, I ran into a little rain on the way up here, and I called my wife just as I was getting here, and she said there was a downpour in Lansing right now. So it has been dry. I mean, as I look around my yard, my diverse community of grasses, which I call a lawn,
okay,
is dormant. It's kind of like straw colored.
So,
but the weeds are still green.
Well, yeah, let me ask you this about your diverse culture. You said of grasses. Is it all grasses or does
no,
it?
No, I should say a diverse community of plants.
Okay. From past experience, thought that was more correct.
I mean, when you get out in the country, having that beautiful lawn isn't as important, although some people still go through that. But when I have such a large area, it's too expensive to maintain that beautiful Kentucky bluegrass blend that everybody likes. Well,
to me, the beautiful lawn is seeing it mowed and it's green.
Yeah, nice and green, yeah. Because unless you look really closely, you don't notice all the diversity.
That's right.
And that is interesting, too, because if you don't have a billiard table type lawn and you look closely, a friend taught me this, there are some such tiny, tiny little flowers in your lawn that you don't even notice. Like there's a teeny little thing called speedwell thyme. So tiny. And these mouse-eared chickweed. Tiny, tiny flowers, but so beautiful.
Actually, once in a while when I just don't get around to mowing my lawn because the mower's down, I have to do some maintenance, you'll start to see all kinds of little flowers blooming in the yard, and it's just really cool. I don't even know what all of them are, and I know quite a few of the weeds, but there's one little pink flower that I haven't looked it up yet, but it's kind of cool.
Yeah, we had a whole carpet of white flowers that were about 10, 12 inches high there while we the summer, but they're not there right now.
Well, one of the ones I really liked was orange hawkweed, which is a beautiful orange. But the problem with orange hawkweed and yellow hawkweed is that they will spread and they'll either even outcompete the grass, even if you have quack grass in that lawn.
Yeah, overpower the crack.
Oh, yeah. But it is kind of nice and it's cool to see it bloom every now and then.
Absolutely. Well, you know, we should get down to business. That's the quiz. So.
All right.
Oh,
so
the fun part.
We're in August now, and do you know that it's National Peach Month?
I did not.
You do now.
I do now. That's right.
So the questions are basically centering on peaches, and the first question is, where is the earliest known area of peach cultivation?
I thought, you know, when I was really small, there was Red Havens, and all I could think about is all those havens along the lake, you know, South Haven, Grand Haven, and such.
Yeah, there's a glow haven, a rich haven. There's quite a few havens.
I always thought that peaches came from Grand Haven.
Yeah, Southwest Michigan, yeah.
That's right.
Well, that would not be right, Tom.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm going to vote for the thing that seems like 75% of the time it's China.
That's right, Sue. That's 10 points for you. Anyway, they believe that peaches were first cultivated in China, and they've been there and under cultivation for about 4,000 years. And there's a lot of vast genetic diversity in China. So if you want to have a breeding program with peaches, that's a place to get some of what we call germplasm.
Wow. Hey, let me ask you a question about where Sue kind of alluded that many things came from China. Is it just because of its large land mass and it's because it's so large, it has a lot of climates?
Well, one thing is we have records.
Okay.
And
they kept good records, huh?
Yeah, they have records of what was grown there. But when I think about it, if you go back to the time of the flood, mm-hmm. where everything was messed up.
Right.
One of the things I wonder about is, did they have plants on the ark or seeds on the ark? Or were those seeds just survived the flood and started growing where the climate was best for them? Mm-hmm. But in China, there are peaches and related species that grow in the various provinces that go from warm subtropical south.
That's what I was thinking.
All the way to the cold, dry north. So that has to be a lot of genetic diversity, because subtropical would be the place in the United States where oranges grow.
Right.
But you certainly couldn't grow them in Michigan without, you know, really special protection. Then the second question is, when did peaches come to North America? If you can just get the century.
Okay.
I'll consider that a win.
I know that I got the answer to this one, Tom.
And who brought them?
Well,
the pilgrims did. No,
nope, not the pilgrims.
Okay, well, no, they had, I think they were here before that, but I read something in this program where they were talking about it, and it was before Jamestown, so it had to be like the 16th century or something.
It was 1500s, so I guess I would consider that the 16th century. And they were brought here by Spanish monks.
Yeah, they were busy in Florida there for a long time before we ever got around to, you know, Boston and Plymouth Rock and all that business.
Now, I didn't find out where they introduced it to the United States, but obviously it has to be in a place that is cool enough for the peaches to be able to grow, because peaches have to have what's called a chilling period of so many hours below a certain temperature in order for them to produce fruit. Okay, the next one is, what are the top five peach-producing states? And then where does Michigan fall into peach production? And that would be in a 1 through 10 range.
So who do you think is number one? I bet it's California, because they're so big and they have their Mediterranean climate all the time.
We're going to have to start handicapping you. Very good.
I'm already handicapped.
They really produce a lot. They produce about 475,000 tons of peaches and nectarines.
How come it seems like we hear more about East Coast peaches? I mean, I wouldn't.
Because they have better marketing.
Well, that's closer. That can be part of it, but it's also closer, because we do grow peaches in the south and in the north. So, but the majority of peaches, and most likely a lot of those peaches, are processed. So peaches that you get from Del Monte or wherever, if they're coming from the U.S., because you have to read the labels now, because things are coming out of China now. But they do a lot of processing peaches. But number two,
you know,
who do you think number two is?
I think it's got to be, it's not Georgia, because we went through there. Georgia is not, it's like South Carolina, even though they're not as big as Georgia.
It is South Carolina. And they're at number two at 67.4 tons. Georgia comes in third at 24.8. Then Pennsylvania.
Wow. Where did that come from?
16.6. Colorado, 14. And then
Colorado?
Michigan. Yeah, then Michigan comes in. I would have thought New Jersey would have been in there somewhere, but anyway.
You know, I did read something. You know, this is what gave me that clue for the 16th century is I saw something they had about the Revolutionary War, and they did talk a little bit about, you know, coming to the point where they were writing the Constitution and kind of the aftermath of the war. And they had some letters and diaries and things about this loyalist. He had decided that he had to stay loyal to the king. So he was forced to return to England. You know, they didn't want him here. And he writes in there with longing about having just missing the, it was so cold in England all the time, he thought. And he was longing for, how did he put it? Honest South Carolina peach. That's how he put it.
Well, I don't know if you know this or not, but South Carolina and Georgia have a thing between who's the best tasting peach. But now, who do you think the top world producers are, and where do you think the United States falls into that group?
Of course, it's probably China again.
Ding, 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 ding.
I'm beginning to think that they do way too many of that.
By a lot. I mean, it's like 14.4 million tons. And then Spain comes in second, and they're at 1.5 million. Then Italy, and then the United States. Although when I looked in another source, World Atlas, it puts Turkey in the top three. So I'm not sure about that one.
It's kind of like they like that that mountainous Mediterranean type climate thing going on there.
As long as it's not too warm. I mean, they can take the heat, but they have to have coolness. Now, this is a gimme. Who consumes the most peaches per person in the world?
I know what I'm going to guess on this, and I wouldn't have thought about this. Tom never gets time to watch PBS Poor Man.
Yes.
So I sometimes watch their little half-hour cooking shows. And they have this Greek lady that comes on there, and she, if you don't pay attention to the fish and lamb part of it, there's lots of Greek yogurt in there and a lot of cherries and peaches in her recipes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to say Greece.
Sue, I said it was a gimme. Tom, what's the answer?
China.
It's China.
I think she did that now, just for me.
Now, you should have been able to figure that out when you found out that China produces 14 million tons.
Somebody's got to eat all those peaches. Yeah,
really? I mean, they have so many now, they're sending them over here in the cans. But, yeah, that was a gimme, Sue. You missed that one. That was the hint. But anyway.
Well, I liked your recipes anyway.
Now, here's what I consider a kind of a sad fact, because U.S. peach consumption per person in the year 2000 was about 5.3 pounds. But in 2021, what? It had dropped down to 2.4. And that's peaches and nectarines. And I thought, wow. Peaches are really good. And well, my wife, I think, hit it, because if you've looked at the price of fresh fruit from the stores, it's really gone up in terms of peaches.
So it's price sensitive.
And I think it's price sensitive to a lot of people. But in terms of flavor of getting tree ripened peaches, I'll give up a lot of stuff for those peaches.
Oh, I like a ripe peach or nectarines. I bought some of those when they had them on sale the week before last. Boy, were they good when they were ripe.
Mm-hmm. What if you gave me the choice between fresh peaches, but I could never eat another bag of Doritos? I'd take the peaches. Well, and, you know, Doritos, I think they put something in those things to make you eat them. But
yeah. You know what? There was a farm that was when we were in Grand Rapids. There's a place called Peach Ridge where a lot of peaches are grown.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell you what, you get those things that just came in out of the orchard, and if they're ripe, that's just a totally amazing experience.
Well,
they just smell wonderful, don't they?
Not only that, if you can your own peaches, you wouldn't believe the difference in the flavor between home canned peaches and the peaches that you get in the store.
And the texture.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because they want them firmer in the stores, but they pick them at a point to where you're getting most of your flavor from sugar. Mm-hmm. Because if you eat a ripe peach, it has a much more intricate flavor profile than what you get out of a can.
Oh, I have a question for you, Gary, on mm-hmm. this. I've always wanted to know. What is, I confess I have sort of a fondness. I like peaches and nectarines both. The fuzzy skin doesn't bother me like some people. I can both. But I have to admit a little bit of leaning towards the white flesh ones. I do like them. And what is the main thing? Tell me about that.
Well, peaches come in three different flesh colors. Yellow, which is the most common one that you see here in the United States. White, and also you can have red flesh or yellow that'll have red in it. Now, in terms of flavor difference, I think that especially if you're getting a white fleshed nectarine, it tends to have a slightly milder flavor, but it's hard to describe the profile. It's really delicious when it's ripe. But there are also some differences in terms of the texture, because some of them will be very soft and others will be more crunchy. And we don't normally eat peaches when they're crunchy, but they can be much firmer than what you would traditionally get in a Michigan peach, which is called melting flesh. Mm. But other than that, it's hard to describe the flavor of a nectarine versus a peach, and I don't think there's much of a difference in the flavor of the colors. I haven't detected it anyway. Just slightly different, but it's hard to describe flavor. I don't have the words for it. You just have to try it for yourself.
Which, by the way, on your YouTube channel, which I subscribe to, I haven't seen any of your taste test videos for a long time.
Yeah, well, I've got some planned, but the plants have to grow. So I was going to do one on two plums that I was looking at, but I just started eating the plums instead. But I am going to do that one, though. I just didn't get around to it. My wife wanted to eat the plums, and I said, go ahead. And then I started eating them, and there's this one called Popsicle that is just really great. But we'll get to that another time. I have three more questions. One, which state produces 95% of the U.S. nectarines and peaches?
California?
Correct. Which state is considered the peach state, and why?
I heard that was Georgia, but...
It is Georgia, and it's primarily because of the number of varieties that they've introduced into the trade. And they have quite a breeding program down there.
Hmm.
And then what can you expect your trees to yield, a single peach tree? And I'll give you an example. 22 pounds, 44, 66. Or 88. And I'll give you a little bit of a hint. Well, it's not a hint, but a bushel can weigh between 48 and 52 pounds.
Hmm. I'll go with 88 just because it seems like you could get at least three bushels off your trees.
I'm going to be a little more conservative and go with 66.
And Sue wins the prize today.
Oh, I get the Cupid doll.
66. Of course, that can vary depending on what type of a training system you use, whether the tree is a dwarf or a standard size tree, and how you prune it.
Well, I want our listeners to know that the Michigan Peach Board had nothing to do with this broadcast. So.
No, they didn't, but, you know, a lot of times I get myself worked up and then I want some peaches now.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll have to take you out for peaches instead of dinner tonight. Well,
okay.
Well, listeners, we're going to go to a break, and we'll be back to talk about more items with the good growing with the Garden Guy.
The Bible and God's character are under attack like never before. Here at Strong Tower Radio, we are proud to hold up the Bible as a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path. We believe the Bible is the Word of God and contains the good news of God's character and His great plan of salvation for mankind. If you know and believe this to be true, won't you help Strong Tower Radio proclaim the truth about our God and His Word, the Bible? To do that, go to www.strongtowerradio.org and there, on our secure website, you will find a donate button. Click on that and give as the Lord directs. Thank you for listening and supporting Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.
Hello, folks. We're back with Good Growing with the Garden Guy, Gary Heilig, Tom Majeure, and Sue Majeure, and we're talking about gardening. It happens to be August, and what a wonderful time of the year. It's produce is starting to come into harvest, much to look forward to.
You're starting to get the payoff.
Yes, the payoff. Yes, and I love the payoff. A lot of interesting things. We're recording this about 2 weeks early, and my tomatoes, I'm just seeing my very first red tomatoes. Green peppers, sweet peppers are a couple of them are almost full size. Just a good time.
The blueberries, yeah. The first blueberries.
Got the first blueberries this year. And so.
So things are coming in. I don't want to beat peaches to death, but August is the month where we start getting our peaches. Like Red Haven comes in about the second week. And so I thought if people have peach trees in their backyard, there's some things that you want to consider in terms of how telling how it's ready. First of all, realize, too, that if you're going to process peaches, you can allow them to be a little less mature. And then they can ripen inside if you want. But if you want the sweetest peaches, let them ripen on the tree. And what you want to do is first know what variety you have, because that puts you in the ballpark, because peaches will start coming in August, and then the last of the peaches will finish out in the first couple of weeks of September. So that puts you in the ballpark if you know what variety you have. There are charts online that you could look at. Second thing is smell it. Peaches should start to have an aroma as they get close to being ripe. Another thing is you can squeeze it and either the top or the bottom, and it should give a little bit. Now, if it's still firm but not hard, then you can pick it and it'll take a couple of days for it to soften. But another thing that will tell you that the peaches are ready is when you grab the fruit from the bottom and lift up and twist, it'll come off easily. And so those are all things. And you can also notice that the color changes, the background color from a greenish to yellowish to reddish will give you an indication that it's ready too. And then the final thing is when the raccoons show up and start eating all your peaches.
Then they're right.
And you have to sit out back there with your shotgun.
Oh, last year we had some peaches on our last remaining tree because I need to plant some more. And one day they were there, and the next night there was just pits on the ground.
Oh, my.
The raccoon ate them all. Maybe more than one raccoon, but they're omnivores, and they obviously know the health message.
Hey, I you know, the thing I remember when our mom first started canning peaches in my very young youth was one thing that peaches come with automatically is fruit flies.
They can. They're more likely to be a problem when the peaches start to split. And that's something else you need to understand, that anything that's a stone fruit like cherries, nectarines, plums, apricots, and peaches, if you don't pick them when they should and you get a bigger rainstorm, then they continue to get bigger and they will split.
Split their
and
skin.
Once they split, then the fruit flies, which are attracted to things that are on their way down, they'll be attracted to them and they can lay eggs in the fruit and that type of thing. Now, you do also have to be concerned about that one fruit fly that I've talked about before, the spotted wing Drosophila. They may cause a problem on your peaches as they ripen too. So if you notice little maggots in them, then you know you're going to have to be spraying for that.
Now, doesn't, when you talk about fruit that splits, tomato is fruit, Don't tomatoes, if they get too much water after a drought, split their skins?
They will, especially if it's been dry for a while and then you get a big rain. And they'll develop what they're called growth cracks. And there are two different types. There are radial growth cracks, which they go out from the stem straight across. And then you have concentric growth cracks, which look like concentric rings that start near the stem and outward. Most of the time, people will see the radial growth cracks more than the concentric ones. And that's when disease gets started. They're still usable for fresh eating, but you know, they can get diseases very easily when they're cracked like that. Anytime the skin is broken on a vegetable or a fruit, you can start having problems.
I noticed that, I mean, it seems like field tomatoes tend to have more of the concentric rings.
Yeah, and the thing is, if they're under an irrigation system and they're getting the proper amount of moisture, you don't see those things develop. But you also tend to see it more on certain heritage varieties than the new hybrid cultivars that are grown today. Just like green shoulders, you'll see some varieties that produce green shoulders, and that was bred out of the tomatoes. They found out what genes were responsible for that, but inadvertently, they also found out those genes were linked to nutrition, and the overall nutrition of the tomatoes started to decrease too, which we've talked about in the past.
You know, there's a little trick, if just a little extra here, folks. You know, you can buy these expensive fruit fly traps, and to me, they're expensive. When I had fruit flies in the house, I was like, this is ridiculous, this price. Even at Menards, you know. And I found online a little trick, which seems to work very well. You take a little shallow dish, and you put apple cider vinegar in it, and then you put a little dash of dish soap, preferably a fruity flavor, a little dash in there, and you leave it out, like where the fruit flies are hanging out. And the because, you know, vinegar is, it's not like fresh fruit, you know, but I mean, it's more, it's something that attracts more, like the spoilage factor.
Yeah, they're attracted to fermentation.
Yeah, they're attracted to the apple cider vinegar. They land on that surface, and that little dash of dish soap that you put in there, it keeps the surface tension broken. Mm-hmm. So as soon as they land, they drown.
Yeah, that's true.
And it tastes costs pennies.
That's also what they're called, vinegar flies. Mm. One of the things I did, Sue, is I took one of those fly swatters that were electric. Mm-hmm. And I did that same thing.
I'd
take the apple cider vinegar, put it in the container, and I would turn that thing on and leave it on. You had to tape it because it was a little push button thing. The battery would only last for about 3 days, but it would clear all the fruit flies out of my house within about a day or two. And you'd hear them popping like little caps. What I want to do is work out where I can make one that I can plug in. Mm. And if I can plug it in, you'll have a trap that works 24 hours a day, and they'll just commit suicide by trying to get to the vinegar by going through the screen that's electrified. So
you put a saucer underneath this?
Yeah, a little bowl, and then I have to set the fly swatter on something so that it's flat over top of the bowl. And it works really well. It's just a shame how they kill themselves.
Well, now that we're talking about tips and tricks, I have a couple of gardening things that I can relate to. Blossom end rot.
Yeah, and I'm not surprised we have blossom end rot this year because of the lack of rain. And blossom end rot is actually a calcium deficiency brought on by fluctuating soil moisture levels. So to clear it up, you simply irrigate more and on a regular basis so that you're not having this cycle between very dry soil and very wet soil. And usually you'll see the first couple of fruits will have the blossom end rot, but if you're watering, then that clears right up. And I heard you had a problem on your squash, too.
Yeah, yeah. With the blossom end rot, you said calcium deficiency. Mm-hmm. What can you do to elevate calcium?
There's plenty of calcium in our soils. Now, there are some sprays that people will try to spray the fruit because the calcium is not getting to the developing fruit, and that's why you're developing this blossoming rot. If I remember correctly, it's the plant is moving the calcium out of the fruit for the new parts of the plant, and that causes the rot at the base. But I wouldn't want to go around spraying calcium on all those little fruits. So if you just correct the soil moisture problem, and you can help that by mulching your tomatoes, like with straw or something, so that the moisture doesn't evaporate as quickly. And if somebody is using a rototiller or something for cultivation, you want to cut that out too, because when you cultivate, the water will move from the wet area deeper in the soil up to the dry cultivated soil. So no cultivation, mulching, and making sure to get plenty of moisture. You'll clear that up and you don't have to spray anything.
Okay, now we're ready for snowy mildew.
Yeah, powdery mildew gets on the cucurbits, which would be anything in the squash family. And once it gets started, if you catch it early enough, there are fungicides that are, was one called potassium carbonate. I don't remember any trade names right now, but if you went on Amazon, for instance, and said potassium carbonate fungicide, it'll come up with products, because I've done it. And it has the ability to kill early infections. At least if it's too far gone, you won't continue to get infections if you're using this as a preventative. And it would be considered an organic product. And I don't know if it has an OMRI okay or not, but baking soda could do the same thing, but baking soda is based on sodium, and some plants might be a little sensitive to that. So I wouldn't use that one, but potassium's fine. And it has the ability to stop the early infections of powdery mildew by desiccation, which it dries it out. So that does a good job. But the other things that you can do is try to make sure there's enough space between the plants so air can circulate. Try to make sure that you're growing them in full sunlight so they dry off as quickly as possible after a rain. Don't water in the evening, leaving the leaves wet, because that will, all those things will encourage. And putting down a mulch can help too, because a lot of times the way a plant gets infected is water will splash from the soil onto the plant, and the spores are there. There are spores in the air too, but a lot of diseases are in the soil, and those spores get splashed on the plants.
Actually, I think where mine is, it's coming off the hoop house, and then it's there on the edge of it, and it splashes in, and there's moisture comes off at the top of the greenhouse. Mm-hmm. Somebody said is adding fans that helps with the movement.
Well, that's one of the reasons why they put fans in greenhouses, to move the air, which dries off the plants faster, which decreases your chances for bacterial and fungal diseases.
And another harvest type question is, what's your thoughts on vacuum packing as a way of preserving foods?
We happen to have a vacuum packer. I guess when you vacuum pack something, you tend to get fewer ice crystals when you freeze it. And so, as for instance, we have green beans that we would just put in the bag, and the ice crystals will form from the water. I think vacuum packing is better, but you have to buy the equipment.
But what about the consumables? Once you buy the equipment, how's that compared to?
It's not that expensive, if that's what you're asking about, because once you buy it, they last for years and years and years, and the only thing you're going to have to buy is the plastic that will make the little bags for you.
Does compared to using a Ziploc bag, what is the cost of the once you have the investment of the machine?
My wife usually buys that, so you'd have to ask her that, but it's probably maybe a little bit more expensive, but not significantly.
Okay. And when you vacuum pack something, can you eliminate freezing, or you still have to freeze?
You're still going to have to preserve it, because it's not going to be a complete vacuum. So normally, unless if something's been dried, for instance, like if you dried blueberries or something like that, then you can vacuum pack that. But you'd have to be really good about what the levels were. And it'll probably have to be at least kept cool, because just because you vacuum pack something doesn't mean that fungi can't grow, because we have what we call, and bacteria too, because they're aerobic bacteria, which can grow in the presence of oxygen, and there are bacteria that are anaerobic, which means they don't need oxygen or can do it in very low oxygen environments. So what I would do there, I would probably consult my Ball food preservation book and see if they have anything on vacuum packing there. If you want, I'll check it and get back to you, Tom.
I'd love to know that. Let's talk about cover crops. You put that on the list here, and it's like, that just seems far, far away.
Well, I put that there because if somebody has harvested something in the garden, let's say, for instance, once you finished harvesting your corn, the stalks themselves aren't going to do any good. So usually people will compost those. And so you have this open space. And depending on, now in August, you still have time to plant something like spinach or some lettuce. You may not get, you're not going to get a full head, but you can get a partial head growing. Radishes you can still grow. But if you're not going to put anything in that spot, then you might as well put a cover crop in there. Otherwise, you're going to have weeds. Now, weeds themselves aren't a problem because you can turn those other under too, and the nutrients that they take out of the soil will just be recycled. But you just don't want the weeds to get up to the point where they start reproducing seeds, which will cause problems for you later. So you need to put something there.
Let's define for our listeners what a cover crop is.
That would be things like annual rye. Now, at this time of the year in August and September, you're not going to have much time to put clover and those types of things in. You might get them established, but they're not going to produce very much what we call biomass. Alfalfa is another example of that. Daikon radishes. You'll get some growth, but they won't give you the amount of biomass that you need. So most people will just put a balboa or rye there.
I got some volunteer clover this year because of all the manure I put in, and part of the manure had a lot of clover.
It has the seeds, yeah, because the animals that process that, many of the seeds can go right through their digestive system without any problem at all. And in some cases, they might even germinate more easily because if you have something that has a hard seed coat, the seed is exposed to acid in the digestive system, which will wear away some of the outer seed coat, which will make it easier for that seed to germinate when it comes out the other end.
What's interesting, I did fertilizer, cow manure this year, and I've been just amazed at how it really made the garden just amazing, the greenhouse.
Well, one of the things I suggest people do if they ever get a chance is there is a book called the Encyclopedia of Organic Gardening by Rodeo Press. But if you get one, try to find one of the old ones. And the reason I mention that, because the old one is about 2 inches thick.
Okay.
The newer one is probably half of that. But they used to list in there the analysis of various animal manures. And it was a nice, handy little chart. And you can find out exactly what you're likely to get from cow manure, horse manure, sheep manure, that type of thing. And not only are you getting the nutrients that the plants need, it's in a form that's pretty much available to them to use right away. And you're getting organic matter, and you're getting all kinds of organisms in the soil. And all of those things work together to make the soil healthier.
So give us that title of that book again.
It's called The Encyclopedia of Organic Gardening by Rodale Press, but you want to get the old one. And I check eBay or someplace like that. If I'd find one on eBay.
Alibris.com.
Pardon?
Alibris.com is a really good site to find like out-of-print books and stuff.
Yeah.
Older books out-of-print, Alibris.com.
When I left my extension office job, I had bought a lot of books, references, and I really wanted to take that book with me, but I didn't. Because what, it just was a really nice resource.
What would you say the print date should be in order to get the older version?
I don't
just
know.
Look
what,
at the number well, of pages.
It was back in the, let's see, early 80s that I bought it.
Okay.
So it would be somewhere around the 80s. But the book, like I said, is about 2 inches thick, and it's an orange cover.
Okay, orange cover.
Yeah, kind of like a burnt orange cover.
Great. Well, folks, you're listening to Good Growing with the Garden Guy with Gary Heilig, Sue Majeure, Tom Majeure, and we'll be back after this break.
When you're taking a trip, it's important to stay on the right road and to follow the GPS or roadmap to be sure that you get to your destination. Likewise, on your trip to heaven, it is vital to follow the roadmap, the Bible, God's positioning system. To do that, stay with Strong Tower Radio as we uplift the Bible and proclaim God's character. If you'd like to help with this mission, go to our secure website, www.strongtowerradio.org, and click on the donate button, or call 231-468-2087. We thank you and may God bless you as we proclaim God's character together.
We're back, folks, with Good Growing with the Garden Guy. I'm your host, Tom Majeure. Sue Majeure is my co-host. And, of course, the most important person is Gary Heilig.
Well, if you say so.
Well, we'd be just a bunch of amateurs speaking, but with you, you're the subject matter expert. Well, speaking of subject matter, it's really, really exciting. Gary, you've been educating us about the fertilizers and the different elements. It's been very interesting, and it's almost an encyclopedia here. But tell us about where you're going and what's new this time.
Well, we're going to talk about magnesium in a minute, but I want to start something new where we talk about organic pesticides and the things that I've learned over the years on that would help people use them properly. And the first one I want to talk about and introduce in some cases the things that people didn't know about before, but the first one is called Surround. And I've mentioned that before, but it's not an insecticide, although it has activity on insecticide on insects. But it's classified as a crop protectant. And what it is, it's a very fine clay. It's called kaolin clay. And it's labeled for use on fruits and vegetables. And it does have the OMRI label, which is the Organic Materials Review Institute. So if you're an organic grower and you want to be legit and be able to say that you're growing organic stuff, this is one of the things that you have to have is use products that are approved by this organization.
Now, for the consumer, if it says OMRI certified, what does that mean to them?
Well, it means the same thing as it would for a commercial person, that it's a certified material that's okay to use if you're growing things organically. So now there are organic products on the market at a garden center that are labeled as organic, but they're not certified, because if they have, say, an adjuvant in it, and an adjuvant is something that will cause the active ingredient to work better, but if that adjuvant isn't okayed by OMRI, then it can't be used in organic production for commercial purposes.
Sounds like a discussion, in-depth discussion for another day.
It could be, okay. But I don't know how many people would be that interested. But anyway, so it also does some other things. When a Surround is put on something and it puts on a clay film, and it sort of looks like if you've ever gone down a dirt road and you looked at the trees and shrubs and stuff along the side of the road, sure. And they're coated with dust, that's what your crop looks like after you use this stuff.
Some of our cars had that during the drought period.
Mm-hmm. And it can reduce sunburn on plants. For instance, I planted my avocado trees outside during the summer, and some of them got a little leaf burn. I wasn't all that concerned about it, but had I sprayed it with Surround, I wouldn't have had that issue. And it can reduce sunburn by up to 50%. And it also keeps the plant canopies cooler, which... if you get into plant physiology, when the plant canopy is cooler, it improves its ability to make its own food through what we call photosynthesis. So that can result in higher yields. So this has a lot of other activity other than against insects. And the way it works against insects is when you coat it, the insects don't like that environment for laying their eggs, or they don't like that environment for chewing on the plant because they're getting a mouthful of clay. So they tend to leave things alone.
How does that do the potato beetles I've been having to spray them with?
It probably would deter them somewhat. It may not completely keep them off totally, but you don't have to have them 100% off, because as I've said before, that unless they're eating more than 25% of your leaves, then it doesn't affect the overall crop. So you can live and let live to a certain extent. The other thing is, I always talk about these maggots like apple maggot and cherry maggot and those types of things. When you spray that on the crop, then those maggot flies don't particularly care to lay their eggs on those fruits. So it's an organic way to control various flies. So it's a good product to use. It does require constant agitation, which means it goes in what we call suspension. It's not dissolved. So when it goes into suspension, it can settle out if, say, your sprayer is sitting someplace for a while.
It precipitates.
Right. So what you have to do is keep shaking it every now and then. Even if you're using a handheld compressed air sprayer, you'll have to shake it. But that's not a big problem, because as you're moving around, you just shake it before you spray, and then when you pump it up again, shake it again before you spray.
Now, Sue, you were saying that you came across a book that there's some common household items that you can use for pest deterrence of baking soda. Well, we talked about that a little bit earlier.
Yeah. There was for slugs, and I suppose for snails, if they're a problem, but slugs, you just take your salt shaker and give them a little light sprinkle. And they don't like that. It dehydrates them.
Yeah, but you got to go around salting slugs all the time. Just use coffee.
Well, they don't like sharp eggshells and Fuller's Earth and things, too. They don't like crossing that, I know.
They don't. And there was something. And copper. They won't cross a copper barrier either.
Now, what I'm thinking, I have a few slugs and snails and stuff. The coffee grounds, if I use them, they're on the ground. The slugs are on the leaves. Do you sprinkle this on the leaves?
You can, but it won't hurt the plant at all. But the caffeine in the coffee will kill them. It's that simple.
Mm, okay.
And it works really well. What I always tell people, and I've talked about this before, is the best time to put it down is early in the spring before the slugs have a chance to reproduce a lot. And if you decrease the reproducing population, then slugs won't be as much of an issue. But you could apply it any time during the year in the fall. And I've used it for years, and we never have slug problems. So the other thing I want to say about Surround is that the safety gear that you want to use with it is a respirator or a dust mask, because the clay getting into your nose or eyes is a bit of an irritant. And I guess that's the major thing. It's an eye irritant, but it's not poison per se. And you do eat kale and clay. They call it food grade kale and clay. It's used as a bulking agent in various things. So
kale pectate.
Yeah, kale pectate's a perfect example of that. It's kale pectate is supposed to sell your stomach, if I remember correctly.
Diarrhea.
Is diarrhea? Yeah, well, if you eat clay, I guess that would happen. So, because clay absorbs water.
That's, oh god.
Anyway, moving on.
Gary, how do you know if you have deficiency of magnesium?
Well, what you will see is a yellowing between the veins, but the veins themselves will stay green. Sometimes you'll have a reddish-brown tint around the leaves. And when you have a magnesium deficiency, you can also have early drop of the leaves. And magnesium deficiencies are common in tomatoes, apples, grapes, raspberries, roses, and rhododendrons. So those are the plants you really want to watch. They'll be the first ones that will indicate that your soil is insufficient in that particular nutrient. And it'll be more noticeable in high light conditions. So as you get into the summer, then you'll start to see magnesium problems show up. Now, most people say, okay, now I know what the problem is. What do I do about it? And one of the things is you can amend the soil with compost every year, because as plants break down, the magnesium in those plants will be released back into the soil for plants to pick up again. Also, an easy way to do it is add Epsom salts, and you can do that by mixing Epsom salts about a tablespoon per gallon of water and pour it around the plants like you would do something like Miracle-Gro or Rapid-Gro. Although, if you're using things like Miracle-Gro and Rapid-Gro, they do have some magnesium in them, as well as things like fish emulsion and other things. If you need to get some quickly on the leaves, you can use a spray on the leaves, especially when the leaves are young. They can start to they can pick up nutrients more effectively. When I would also check the pH of the soil. If it's too acidic, you can have problems with magnesium. So you may have to lime, depending on what your situation is with the pH. Manures can help with that problem, especially poultry manure, chicken manure, because it's high in magnesium. And you can also get magnesium from soybean meal. So those are all sources of magnesium. And if you had an old copy of the organic encyclopedia, Organic Gardening Encyclopedia, they have a whole section in there on magnesium and sources of magnesium for the organic gardener.
So we keep coming back to that. The Strong Tower Radio listeners might do a run on this encyclopedia.
Well, you have to find it. Yeah. So remember, it's the old one.
That's right.
That's the best one.
Well, tell us a little bit about harvesting in our last couple minutes.
Well, in August, we're starting to really enjoy our harvest. We're starting to see harvesting of tomatoes. We've had zucchini since July, and so they'll continue to produce. Green beans should be coming out of the garden. Your melons will start to be ready. And I do have a video up if you're growing watermelons, how to tell when a watermelon is ready to harvest.
Good.
And also, if you have ever-bearing strawberries, those will be continuing to produce. In late August, you'll start to get the ever-bearing raspberries. You okay there, Sue?
Yummy. I'm thinking about those raspberries.
But don't forget, you need to spray them for that fruit fly because they like to eat on raspberries too. Sweet corn starts around late July, and so we'll be in the prime time for sweet corn. And if you don't know how to harvest sweet corn, again, note what variety you have. It'll tell you how many days it is. When you get close to that, check the kernels. Test a kernel every now and then, and they should be milky inside. And the silks will be dry, but the silks dry before the corn is actually ready. I like to run my hand along the actual ear of corn, and you should be able to feel the definition of the individual kernels. And
that's with the husk on?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. You don't have to pull it back. You should be able to feel it with it on there. Also, blueberries will be in the middle of their harvest. Also, you'll start getting pears. During that time, we're still harvesting peaches. There are a few early apples, like ginger gold, for instance, that'll be ready in August.
Yummy.
But the majority of apples come in mid to late September, going into October. So there's lots and lots of things that you can harvest. And like I said, in August, some of the leafy greens, like collards, you can still plant. They're not going to get huge, but they don't have to be huge. Just plant a bunch of them. And especially since a lot of the leafy greens, when they're smaller, they're more tender. So there's a lot of good stuff coming out of the garden during that time.
What about replant disease? What is it, and how long does it last?
I put that in there because I was thinking about putting something in there about orchards, and I'm getting ready to replant some fruit trees. And replant disease isn't well understood as to what causes it. They're doing research on it. But it means that if, say, for instance, you've had apple trees or peach trees or pear trees in a certain area and they die, or you take them out for some reason and you want to replant there, well, the plants won't do as well. They won't be as productive. And they're not actually sure what the reason is. I did a little research to find out, could you correct that by fumigating the soil? But I didn't find anything that helped me out a whole lot. So you need to know what has been growing in a particular area if you're going to plant fruit trees. I would just avoid places where fruit trees have been before. Otherwise, you're going to have some issues.
How long can it be fallow? 10 years?
That was a question I asked myself, and I did some research on that. And they said you can still have that effect 15 years after trees have been removed. So, so it's a long time.
Well, very good. Well,
does that apply to your things in your garden? I was thinking, like, is there, like, how long can you plant tomatoes or or, you know, other thing, or peppers in the same spot without, shouldn't you rotate so that you can avoid some of those problems?
Well, it's not necessarily a replant problem. It's just that each plant will take different profile of nutrients out of the soil. And so, for instance, tomatoes are a heavy feeder. So if you grow them in the same place, they're going to deplete the nutrients in that area much faster and also much deeper because the roots go down so deep. And what we try to do is rotate things so that we're not ruining the soil. And the early Native Americans, what they used to do is what's called slash and burn. They grow crops in an area until they wouldn't grow anymore. And then they move on. And that's what a lot of people used to do until the advent of commercial fertilizers, which allow you to go back into an area because you can replenish it. But also we've learned that by putting in compost and manures and things, you can rebuild the soil. So, yeah, it is a good thing to move things around in your garden, and also for disease and insect reasons also.
Well, folks, that does it for this month's Good Growing with the Garden Guy, the August edition with Gary Heilig and your co-host Sue Majeure and Tom Majeure. Until next time, this is Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed. Bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to Strong Tower Radio Network. Our stations reach from Kalamazoo over to Lansing and up to the Mackinac Bridge, and then west to Ironwood on the border of Wisconsin, and even a station in central Illinois. Our most southerly station is 97.3 W247 AM Kalamazoo. Driving north on 131, you can tune to 91.9 WMJC in Richland. Continuing north on 131, you can tune to 89.7 WNHG Grand Rapids. Driving west from Grand Rapids, you can tune to 93.1 WMPA Ferrisburg. Driving north from Grand Rapids, you can continue to listen to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 91.9 FM WGCP Cadillac. Driving east from Grand Rapids to Lansing, you can continue listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 1540 AM KTGG Okemos and 104.7 W284 AH Lansing, as well as 92.3 W222 CU Charlotte. Driving north from Lansing, you can continue listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 90.7 FM WBHL Harrison. Continuing your drive north, you can keep listening to Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 93.9 FM WAVC Mayo and 102.7 FM W274BN Alpena. Crossing over the beautiful Mackinac Bridge, you can hear Strong Tower Radio by tuning to 97.9 WIHC Newberry. Driving west of Newberry, Strong Tower Radio can be received by tuning to WUPJ Escanaba on 90.9 FM. Driving further west, tune to 91.3 FM W217CG Ironwood. And lastly, in the heart of the land of Lincoln, tune to Strong Tower Radio on 91.3 FM W217BB Hickory Point. Strong Tower Radio, where God's character is proclaimed.